I'm Christopher Lydon, ready to decipher the WikiLeaks story with two esteemed students of networks and power, James Dedarian, my colleague at Brown University, and Ron Diebert at the University of Toronto. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is about the universal wake-up call in the age of the internet. First blood, perhaps, between the open information culture of the web and established power in the Western democracies. It's not China this time cracking down on Google and email freedom. It's the Obama administration that is stunned to have its own diplomatic cables sprung on the world by leakers in the first place, and then by Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, the new clearinghouse of all the world's secrets. James Dedarian does the heavy lifting at the Global Media Project at the Watson Institute. Ron Diebert runs the Canada Center for Global Security Studies in Marshall McLuhan's old campus in Toronto. We all know that Julian Assange is not the essence of this story, but we've got to deal with him. Bill O'Reilly wants him assassinated. Vladimir Putin's Moscow says he should get the Nobel Peace Prize. Put him in context, would you, Ron Diebert?
Well, you know, what did he do? He received documents, reportedly. I'm not sure of all the details myself, but from what I understand, he received documents and published them and made arrangements with media organizations. Anyone could have done that. What he did on top of that, of course, was add a homegrown theory that drives all of this about what he perceives to be some of the threats to openness and democracy in the world, and what he interprets will be the impact of his organization's actions.
Could I ask you, James Dedarian, if Julian Assange is this kind of everyman with some deep and sometimes difficult to understand motivation, how should we place him? Is he a political figure? Is he the Daniel Ellsberg of our time who released the Pentagon Papers in the early 70s? Who is he to you?
Well, Daniel Ellsberg did identify him now as the most dangerous man of our era, echoing, you know, charges that were leveled against him after he leaked the Pentagon Papers. But I think that basically Assange was a nobody. He was very much part of a network, but what elevated him to this position is increasingly access to the mainstream media. It wasn't until, you know, you had four and then five major newspapers begin to run the leaks, give it the imprimatur of the press, that suddenly he was elevated now to a figure. And then when he began to threaten the monopoly of the state on diplomacy, then he became a demon. So in some ways, his elevation is very much part and parcel of the fading power of sovereign states and the rising power of networks. And this is like, you know, the state lashing out. You know, don't mess with our last monopoly, which is violence and diplomacy, state-to-state negotiations. So in this regard, he is a symptom of, I believe, an increasing erosion of state sovereignty and an increasing supremacy of network power.
I want to subscribe to the Jay Rosen school of what this is all about. He says WikiLeaks is the world's first stateless news organization. I mean, way beyond the BBC or Reuters. The first stateless news organization that is showing, most important perhaps, that our news organizations are very significantly statist.
Well, certainly in the history of, you mentioned Reuters, and you could look at the history of transnational news services, you know, UPI, they usually corresponded to empires. The spread of imperial power was accompanied by these various news services, Agence France, even TASS. They sort of covered wherever the domain of that state power reached. What's interesting is, does WikiLeaks represent any power within the spread of particular networks? Is there an interest here that we need to look at that's being furthered to the detriment of, you know, call it what you will, you know, the popular will that we just tend to see identified with the internet?
Could I ask you both, just as a practical matter, have we met here in WikiLeaks the sort of ultimate penetrating inquiry. Can this what is the risk of a kind of all-out war of Chinese hackers against our hackers? MIT enters as a third party. How could this escalate?
It is you see how something like this can trigger because of cascading effects, because of the densely, interconnected nature of the internet and of control systems, that these cascading effects can run out of control very fast. You could have the equivalent of a World War I scenario. Here we had a small little incident, and now it's, Bosnia, where, the assassination of the Archduke led to a confrontation that's, killed millions of individuals. What caused that to happen is because treaties, and this is where we can bring diplomacy in and why I think the most recent leaks have, created such an uproar. Diplomacy was very much a secret game. You had – every treaty had a secret article connected to it that said if you are attacked by country X, we will come to your support. Well, it created this basically an effect of a densely networked system that, you trigger – you push one little button and the next thing you know, Germany had to go to war, Germany having an agreement, with Austria, and then – England having an agreement with Serbia, and the cascading effects went out of control very swiftly. So when we now talk about Anonymous, this group that's launching attacks on MasterCard or other sites that are connected in one way or another to the WikiLeaks incident, you can see how secrecy, the very thing that Assange is trying to reveal about diplomacy, is at the heart of this question. Transparency and secrecy. So when you talk about cybersecurity, you can be sure the state is not going to be sharing, what its plans are for defense that could quickly then – what they see as a defensive maneuver could quickly be perceived as an offensive one and then create this cascading, what Ron says, arms race.
If I could just jump in here. I think that's
Ron Diebert, please.
A very nice way to characterize it. And I'd just add that there is a kind of normative climate right now of fear and insecurity. And at the same time, I think we need to be cautious about drawing doomsday scenarios that could be used as ammunition for people who put forward really radical proposals to re-engineer the internet. Let's not forget that part of the characteristic of cyberspace itself is a great deal of redundancy. So yes, when a system goes down, it can affect a lot of critical infrastructures, but it can also be contained quite effectively because of the nature of the network itself. There are many national computer emergency response teams, essentially technocrats who monitor the internet as if they were reporting on weather systems and cyclonic effects and containing them accordingly. Those groups probably need nurturing, and that's the most effective way that we could sustain this ecosystem in an open way as a commons of information while not succumbing to some of the fear-mongering that usually has some ulterior motive behind it.
Ron Diebert and James Derderian, I'd love you both to talk not so much about the arms race in cyberspace, but what a war in cyberspace might look like. Who fights whom? Over what? Who gets hurt? What does it cost? I mean, who are friends? Who are peacemakers? What's the global interest in this global medium now?
Well, I would say we have plenty of evidence of different aspects of this. One is Ron used the sort of weather metaphor, and in this case, it's very hard to identify who started the hurricane. Complexity theory. It could
butterfly in Oceania, right?
Exactly. So with complexity theory and complex systems, attribution, intentionality, return address to create deterrence or have some sort of retribution is nearly impossible. But at another level, we see it taking place right now in terms of information warfare between the United States and, as Ron has put it, these asymmetrical, powers. In the most, notorious case is jihadi media, in the way that, Rumsfeld loved to talk about, bin Laden's, this guy in a cave. Well, he's a guy in a cave who had access to networks, and that would act as a force multiplier. And in this regard, I think that you're seeing this war having real consequences for recruitment of, you know, suicide bombers. It has real consequences in to the extent that the United States still believes that, you know, you can take out a node to this network, be it, you know, the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and stop it. And that's not the nature of information warfare. Information warfare is not a precision munition. It's a broadcast medium. And so the whole idea you can do smart war against, you know, this type of threat is, I think, dubious. It's much more you need complexity theory. And Ron's, you know, bringing up of technocrats, yes, they have a better sense of how complexity works. But at the same time, you know, they have their own bureaucratic interests. I'd like to see more public accountability than people doing things in secret.
Stalin would be asking here, you know, how many networks has the Pope?
Well, if you know, the way I would answer that, I think it's actually a very good question, and it needs to be answered again in a nuanced way by understanding what it is that we're talking about when we refer to something called cyberspace. And here it's important to reiterate that what we're talking about here is a multi-level domain that ranges from the virtual, the idea realm, the space that the three of us are occupying right now, all the way down to the physical infrastructure, the cables through which the information passes, and the logical layer, the code layer, the software that is increasingly used as a vector for the type of exploitation and attacks that we're seeing becoming more common. And if you look at it that way, there is really a geopolitics of cyberspace, a competition over this domain from the idea level all the way down to the physical infrastructure. Here again, it needs some nuance and some qualification. Most of what we call cyberspace is actually owned and operated by the private sector, as much as 95% of it. And so for governments to be able to do what they want to do, to project national power, to compete against each other, to fight and win wars in cyberspace, they have to either co-opt or coerce the private sector to cooperate with them on that agenda. I also think in terms of specific conflicts, much more research needs to be done here. There's an area that is really ripe for primary interdisciplinary research. A good case that we looked at recently is the Russia-Georgia conflict over South Ossetia in 2008. I think it was a great example of a conflict that, on the surface at least, appeared to be a very traditional old-style conflict, tanks roaring across borders, people dying in trenches and so on. There was very poor information connectivity in the region, generally speaking. But the coinciding with the conflict on the ground was a major denial of service attack against the Georgian government and websites of key ministries and the banking sector that really disabled the government of Georgia, made it difficult for them to react to this conflict and coordinate their own activities. Looking at it as we have very systematically and through a combination of field research and technical analysis, we found out exactly what James was talking about. Determining who is behind this denial of service attack is almost impossible. The vector of the attack, the way it was coordinated, took place over compromised computers in dozens of countries. In fact, most of the debilitating requests for information that brought down the Georgian government actually took place from commandeered computers that were located in the United States, which is a curious kind of mix when we think about the constitution of forces or the constellation of actors in a conflict today. You can have networks in countries completely separate from the zone of conflict participating in the conflict itself, even voluntarily, as some journalists. There was one in particular writing for Slate magazine, downloaded the tools to engage in computer network attacks against Georgian government websites, did it, and then wrote about it as a spectator and participant in the conflict. That's really something quite novel.
James, we're talking about the ultimate in asymmetrical warfare. Can you imagine a scenario of how these forces would play out in any part of the world? Pick one.
Well, I think the most immediate example was before 9/11, there was one Al-Qaeda website. After 9/11, 4,000. a war's been going on to take down the sites, you know, counteroffensives. You know, they took down Daniel Pearl's, you know, decapitation. Then it shows up again. It is so in this case, I think there is an advantage to the disadvantaged. I think that if we're going to be looking for the next threat, it's going to be the one, you know, it's the black swan. You know, in my mind, it's the one that's going to use to its advantage the interconnectivity and the anonymity of the web to its advantage. Because anonymity, people say, can be a good thing or a bad thing. You know, anonymity right now, if you want to avoid, you know, attack by, you know, call it what you will, totalitarian power, authoritarian power, or even simply, you know, state power, that people see this to be a boon, a good thing. But anonymity also means there's not accountability. And I'm all for more transparency on both sides of this struggle. So the worst scenario in my mind is that the lesson we learn from WikiLeaks is more opacity. You know, bring down the shutters, close up Citizen Lab. You know, that's my worry.
But meantime, are the computer systems that operate an American Navy carrier, for example, as vulnerable to being stolen or distributed or handed over to somebody else as all those diplomatic cables? In other words, could the Strategic Air Command find out one morning that somebody else has the computer keys to the way it works?
Well, as we now know, a dry cleaner had them for a very long time when Clinton lost them, which was even more alarming. I think as well, I would agree with Ron, there's all kinds of fail-safes for the worst possible scenarios. There's firewalls. There's, you know, the equivalent of the fail-safes we know from, you know, nuclear weaponry. So I don't want to be alarmist, but I think it's what we can't imagine. And state bureaucracies are notorious for a lack of imagination. I mean, 9/11 was not a lack of intelligence. It was a classic example of a failure of imagination.
Let me just add here.
Please.
I think that keep in mind the context behind all of this is that we're moving in a remarkable rate towards a new mode of communicating just within the last 5 years. If you think about all of the social networking, mobile technology.
Yeah, spell it out.
4 billion cell phones in the world today, most of them standard equipped to upload images to Twitter and YouTube and videos to YouTube. Most people who use the latest smartphones have no idea that there is metadata contained in each of those photos that can be harvested by people to determine the exact geolocation where that image was taken, when it was taken, unbeknownst to the person who uploaded it to Twitter. So we're migrating to this new way of communicating without developing the usual norms and protocols around basic security practices. And as James said, large organizations typically are not well-crafted to think ahead around what happens in unintended ways or at the margins. I would also say that it's important to keep in mind that there is a for lack of a better term, a kind of demographic shift happening in cyberspace. It started out very much as an American dream, a West Coast libertarian ethos informed cyberspace at the beginning because, frankly, that's where it was invented. But over the last couple of decades, it's migrated outward. And now we're seeing the highest rates of growth occurring in zones of conflict in the developing world. There is a migration from the north and the west to the south and the east in cyberspace. And I think that is going to change the character of cyberspace. When I look at most of the groups that we study, these are, you know, cyber criminals, underground economies in places like Lagos or St. Petersburg or Shanghai. For individuals in these places, connecting to cyberspace is a way for them to get out of the structural economic inequalities that they face on a day-to-day basis. And it's really a challenging, elegant way to make money, sometimes in a very victimless fashion. And then, of course, when you're being encouraged to do so by the forces that be, that makes it even more attractive. And so, you know, I see these organizations looking at new opportunities and in the course of doing so, beginning to affect the character of cyberspace in ways that we simply couldn't have imagined as recently as 5 years ago.
Ron and James, could I bring it back to the relatively mundane matter of getting the news out? I mean, I haven't read but a few of those hundreds of thousands of WikiLeaks pages. But it's exciting. It's very authentic to actually hear what American diplomats consider their real interests or our real interests or what they think of Sarkozy or the Saudi princes or whatever, and also to receive it from a kind of transnational source. So you begin to see ourselves in the world in a kind of broader perspective. What is the danger of that sort of model of a new news business where you'd actually see the documents as they happen? What's the downside? James Dudarian.
Well, I would go back to the theme of, you know, opacity and transparency. And the reason why this round of WikiLeaks created, I think, such an uproar is because it went after that shibboleth that you know, diplomacy cannot function without secret negotiations. That it's going to undermine the stability of the world order because of these revelations. And I think that's completely overstated at one level. And everybody goes back to show the last attempt at this and how – what a disaster it was. You know, the pundits were talking about Woodrow Wilson. You know, he had this crazy idea of the 14 points. It was the first of the 14 points, you know, open covenants openly arrived at. Well, you know, that idea took – you know, was presented at the time because – again, going back to World War I, it was closed secret diplomacy in the interest of a very small elite that helped bring about one of the most disastrous, I would argue probably the greatest disaster of the modern international system. So, you know, rather than Woodrow Wilson, we should go back to another figure in this period, Trotsky, who when he took over the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in the new Soviet Union, he said, well, I'm going to issue a few proclamations and open up the safes, which he did. Historians would not have had that history, you know, of all those secret agreements if it hadn't been for the fact he opened up the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the WikiLeaks of his day, to show, look at what these guys were doing. Look at the machinations, these diplomats of the aristocracy, these sort of, you know, guys who belong in the dustbin of history. But the way they held on to their power, clung to it, was to make themselves essential.
The Guardian, the newspaper in London, has been having a field day with the hypocrisy of Hillary Clinton and others in the Obama administration in now cracking down on this, what they used to celebrate as a wonderful, exemplary tool of general information. It was earlier this year that Hillary Clinton was torturing the Chinese rhetorically for their crackdowns, and she was lionizing Barack Obama for defending the right of people to freely access information. He had said that the more freely information flows, the stronger societies become. He spoke about how access to information helps citizens to hold their governments accountable, generates new ideas, it encourages creativity, blah, blah, blah. It sounds, as the Guardian said now, like a masterpiece of satire. They can't crack down fast enough against the people who have shredded the emperor's clothes, you know, right in front of our eyes. They have revealed not so much secrets as a kind of cumulative incompetence in all these diplomatic fiascos that it's about time for some sunshine. You have to wonder, though, are our leaders in the Obama administration so embarrassed that they're going to have us all bidding farewell to the ideal of an informed conversation about transparent facts? Is this the end of the open internet is what I'm wondering.
Well, I'll take a crack at that. And, you know, as someone who's been spending the last decade examining this question, I could say that this is, you know, only one small incident in a long evolution towards a gradually enclosed internet space. And I think if you're looking at contradictions, I would call it, instead of hypocrisy of the U.S. government, yes, Senator Clinton came out in January with a very forceful defense of an open internet. And the State Department has a quite ambitious agenda to support openness and access to information online. It pales in comparison to the type of support that's given to the exact opposite. And there's all sorts of examples we could go through. I mean, one of the best for me was when Senator Clinton stood up and defended Research in Motion and BlackBerry in their struggles against the demands being made on them by the UAE, India, Bahrain, Indonesia, and others for access to their encrypted data. And only a few weeks later, the Obama administration introduced legislation that would allow them, their law enforcement and intelligence, access to the very same data that they were condemning those governments for. So right now, there's a kind of a perfect storm, if you will, is the way I would characterize it, in cyberspace, where you have major constituencies lining up with agendas that are very much oriented around closure and engineering the internet in such a way that allows law enforcement intelligence a much more much greater capacity to do things like monitor, survey, filter information, so on. Their agenda is being complemented by the private sector, who are doing the very same things for other reasons, mostly for commercial reasons, marketing reasons, tracking people's habits, and so on. In fact, this is the one area I've found where the NSA and the Chinese Public Security Bureau line up on the same side. They both want to re-engineer the internet to do away with anonymity. In the face of all of that, the voices for internet openness are minuscule. And so to me, the WikiLeaks, the reaction to it, the histrionics, the calls for assassination of Assange and the pressuring of hosting companies, this is nothing new. I see this happening on a daily basis. Every week in India, there is a new informal pressure being exercised by some government minister to remove some Facebook group or a Google group that's discussing something that's embarrassing for the regime or a violation of some habit or more. Same thing in Pakistan, Vietnam, China, all over the world. The same sort of pressures are coming together in what I would say is kind of a perfect storm.
You know, I always feel that we bum people out on this program too much. I think that Ron and I have talked about, you know, the early promise, West Coast promise, and then we see how it seems like closed systems always win out, despite the architecture of openness in our political systems and our, you know, technological systems. And I always look for the little beacon of light here, and I have to say that others will be inspired by this and they'll learn the lessons. Don't get involved in Swedish sex crimes before you undertake a major revelation against a superpower, if alleged sex crimes. Don't allow yourself to be blackmailed. And, you know, ultimately, I think that, you know, the lesson is, God, if we'd only had Assange before, you know, or after the Gulf of Tonkin, before we, you know, went and sent troops into Vietnam, or before in March 2003 we went into the Iraq War. We've seen the consequences. You know, in some ways, Joe Wilson is a sort of more, you know, buttoned-down version, the guy who sort of blew the whistle on the, mm-hmm. you know, the famous claim that there was yellow cake being transported to Iraq. That was one of the, you know, casus belli for the war.
That brings it back to a very important point I want to raise about the Afghan war. You can read a lot of these documents, and the Guardian columnists do read them this way, to say that the war in Afghanistan is lost, and everybody knows it. They don't like Karzai. He's corrupt. He's got bad brothers. He's got a million problems. And even militarily, that this war is unwinnable. Will the Obama administration so zealously pursue the war that it has to silence this evidence?
Were it so, but this is what my point I was about to finish on, is that really the difference between the earlier, you know, versions of Revelation, Pentagon Papers, and its political effects is now you have the increased news cycles. I'm very much afraid that we will have forgotten WikiLeaks by, you know, the next, you know, news cycle of some sort of crisis or revelation. This is a case where information overload, white noise, media spasms work against the openness of the internet. People just move on. And instead of talking about cyberspace, we should talk about cyberpace. That's the speed by which the information is being conveyed, as opposed to simply the content of it. that is having the most immediate political effects.
Right. If I can jump in and pick up on this point about the future of all of this, in spite of all that I said before, I think I'm even more optimistic than James about it. And that's because of a few big factors again here. One is that we've created this ecosystem that is difficult to reverse entirely. We've created the first artificial domain that encompasses the globe as a whole. And IP is everywhere. We're connected to it in so many disparate ways with tiny devices now. People, organizations, whole economies are linked together in this. And that's part of the reason why you have such major attention being devoted to securing it. Governments realize, whereas in the past they didn't, that they just can't ignore this domain. And I think what is going to happen, at least I hope it will happen, is that whereas in the past, well-meaning, well-intentioned people like, say, Perry Barlow, who assume there was something mysterious and magical about this technology. It couldn't be controlled. This is a new thing that we've created. It will mean the end of governments as we know it. Now have to realize, hey, we just can't take it for granted. We actually have to fight for it. And that means opening it up, which is the aim of the research that we've done here at the Citizen Lab, just speaking for ourselves, is to demythologize the technology, lift the lid on it, explore what goes on beneath the surface, expose the way in which governments are manipulating this domain in order that we can protect and preserve it right from the idea level all the way down to the physical infrastructure level and not leave anything shrouded in secrecy. Once we get to that point, when I think people are now beginning to realize, when I send that email, where does it go? It doesn't just go off into the ether. It goes down the fiber optic cable to an internet service provider. I need to look at that internet service provider's end user license agreement, because I'm beginning to see that when I use my BlackBerry, my information might not be entirely secure or confidential. It might be shared with a government like the UAE that doesn't respect basic human rights. And the more that people begin to understand and interrogate issues like that, the more they'll want to craft, I hope at least, a constitution for cyberspace, let's call it, that protects and preserves and builds into the architecture basic protections for human rights like access to information, freedom of speech, and privacy.
James, do you want to up the optimism ante?
Oh, I wish I could, but I don't have the Ron's advantage. He comes from an enlightened, benevolent, underpopulated peacemaking country like Canada. When you're living at in the belly of the beast, you tend to take a darker view of it. But I just like echo one thing. Diplomacy to be effective, it's not so much whether it can negotiate behind closed doors, but it's rather whether or not it appreciates the local cultures of conflict. And that's where I think we have to improve, and where maybe the internet can help. In the way that Richard Holbrooke, God rest his soul, who just passed away, his great virtue was not his ability to bully people, his abrasiveness, or all these things that people are focusing on now. It was really, he was a master of improv. He took jazz as his sort of inspiration. And I think that in this regard, Assange is too much, taking speed metal, as his inspiration. People on the internet, I think, could learn from some of these, people who understood the importance of matching up the culture with the technology. You don't negotiate the same way with, Milosevic as you would negotiate with Karzai, that you would negotiate with, the Chinese leaders. And this is the arrogance of a superpower that I think is not shared in Canada, Canadians have a long history of understanding this and why they've been very effective peacemakers.
Could I improv a last question about the performance of the news media itself? WikiLeaks represents, of course, a lethal threat to their role. I mean, if you can give the world a daily documentary of actual happenings, who's going to read the New York Times? At the same time, the Times itself, it seems to me, has been schizophrenic here. They've led the attacks, really, the polite attacks, but the devastatingly personal attacks on Julian Assange. At the same time, they are publishing the documents. It's kind of striking. There's no blackout here. It's the Pentagon Papers all over again, in the sense that we're being allowed to being given a very intelligent selection of a wonderfully interesting scoop. How they doing?
Well, you know, I understand some of the hand-wringing that especially journalists do about the death of traditional media, but I'm always struck by the extent to which people reflexively turn to the major media outlets when they want to have a big impact, and I count myself included. Same goes for WikiLeaks. There was a brilliant analysis I read recently where a lot of the WikiLeaks documents that were released in previous years went unnoticed until of this more concerted strategy around co-timing the releases, trickling them out like an IV drip with coordinated traditional media coverage. And I think that is to Assange's credit, frankly, that he recognizes that these institutions still play an important role as intermediaries.
Yeah, I think, Ron, your great iconic figure, of course, put it best. The medium's the message. If you can't get access to the medium that is going to have the most eyeballs and certainly comes with the authority of the New York Times, it often falls on deaf ears and certainly won't have the political traction. But what is interesting about this is that some of the story did get filtered out. You know, the New York Times refused, and they actually vetted these documents with the State Department and refused to publish some that were considered potentially harmful to individuals. So there was a filter. It wasn't completely unfiltered. And I think that in the future, what always happens in these sort of new technologies, you'll see not just a convergence but a consolidation that perhaps, you know, all future leaks must go through mainstream media, both for protection under First Amendment, but also because it's the, you know, one of the ways to guarantee that audience that you talk about.
James Derderian and Ron Debert, thank you for this conversation. You have confirmed this sense we all have that it's a new, not only a new world, but it's a completely new information regime being born in this whole WikiLeaks story. We'll pursue it again with you, I hope.
Well, lovely to be on your show, Chris, after many years of listening.
Thank you.
Yeah, call anytime.
James, thank you too. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the conversation.